This hour of the Jason Rant Show is brought to you by mmcomfortsystems.com. Lots of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending. It is the Kyle Rittenhouse trial underway, coming to an end. Prosecutor Thomas Binger finished his closing statements earlier this afternoon, and the defense is now concluding their final statements. And it's going along the lines that we sort of thought it would go. You have on the prosecution side trying to change things up at the last minute, hoping people will fall for their spin. And what they're doing right now is spin. They have departed almost fully from where they started. Because Thomas Binger is telling you that Kyle Rittenhouse is guilty on all counts. One of those counts, by the way, was the gun charge that was tossed today by the judge. We'll get into that in a little bit. But he wants you to think that Kyle Rittenhouse went to Kenosha with the intent of killing people, that he decided to go there with the intent of killing someone, multiple people. Somehow he just happened to shoot at the people who were attacking him. And by the way, they attacked first. All the video shows that. But they're trying to spin that. The Biden administration, meanwhile, wants you to think, CNN and MSNBC talking heads want you to think that Kyle Rittenhouse is some white supremacist who went to Kenosha to kill, even though all of the so-called victims are white. But the prosecution wants you thinking he did it with this intent to kill, even though he was the one being attacked, even though it's on video for everyone to see. We can point to the video. We can actually look at the video and see exactly what happened. He shot the people who very clearly posed the threat and were the aggressors. But we're supposed to ignore all the video. We now live in a nation filled with gaslighting. The Biden administration has been doing it for a very long time. Democrats have been doing it for longer. We are supposed to ignore everything that we're seeing. This trial, in a lot of ways, has become the legal version of this protest is mostly peaceful. There's some skirmishes here, but it's mostly peaceful as buildings are burning behind the person delivering that message. Got it. So now they're saying that Rittenhouse was the one who provoked the first victim, Joseph Rosenbaum. Let's turn on my computer audio, and I'm going to play that clip in a second. I'll play that audio in a bit. We're having a little bit of a technical difficulty. But he basically said that Rittenhouse went out there and he pointed his gun at Rosenbaum. And Rosenbaum then decided to defend himself by going towards the guy with the AR-15. Now, if that doesn't really make sense to you, it's because it doesn't make sense. It's because it's a nonsense charge. It's a nonsense claim that when someone who has an AR-15, you don't actually run towards them. You run away from them if your concern is that they are going to attack you. If that is your concern, you run away. But we're being told by this prosecutor that he decided to run towards the violence, towards the guy who's going to shoot him. And then, of course, he follows through and shoots. That he was provoked by the mere presence of a white nationalist who decided to show up with the intent to do harm. It does not make any sense. It's never made sense. And the reason why that they're doing that all of a sudden is because they are losing this trial. So they need to switch the conversation. They need to switch your attention at the last moment.
Under Wisconsin law, you're not allowed to run around and point your gun at people. This is the provocation. This is what starts this incident. The defendant rushes in and immediately points the gun.
Now, of course, he didn't actually point his gun at people willy-nilly. That wasn't what happened. And yet, nevertheless, Binger says,
the only way that you could possibly justify the murder of Joseph Rosenbaum is if you believe that Joseph Rosenbaum was actually reaching for the defendant's gun, and that a reasonable person in the defendant's position,
uh-huh,
with an AR-15 strapped tightly to his chest, would think that Joseph Rosenbaum was even capable of taking that gun away as he's falling to the ground with a fractured right pelvis.
Okay, except Rosenbaum was chasing Rittenhouse. That's the difference here. Kyle Rittenhouse did not stand there pointing the weapon at Rosenbaum. Kyle Rittenhouse, even though he had an AR-15, he ran away from Rosenbaum, who was chasing him to go after his gun. But again, to believe this new twist in the prosecution's case is that Rosenbaum saw Rittenhouse point a gun at him and decided to run at him. That, of course, doesn't make any sense. The entire case hinges on this jury believing that Rittenhouse provoked this violent response. If he actually provoked it, then there's no self-defense claim. That's what he says.
They have to convince you that Joseph Rosenbaum was going to take that gun and use it on the defendant because they know you can't claim self-defense against an unarmed man like this. You lose the right to self-defense when you're the one who brought the gun, when you're the one creating the danger, when you're the one provoking other people.
He's basically saying that because Kyle Rittenhouse brought a gun, he, of course, is the only one who was the threat, not the person who was running after him, Rosenbaum. Not Zeminski, who he didn't mention in the closing, was the guy who fired a shot and had a gun. That gun, though, was just a handgun, and thus it wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, listen to the way Thomas Binger talks about self-defense.
Convince you that Joseph Rosenbaum was going to take that gun and use it on the defendant because they know you can't claim self-defense, okay, against an unarmed man like this.
That's not true.
You lose the right to self-defense when you're the one who brought the gun.
That's also
when you're
true.
The one creating the danger, when you're the one provoking other people. The defendant fired 4 shots at Joseph Rosenbaum and caused 5 wounds to him.
Okay. So what he just said, and I'll let a lawyer provide some commentary in a moment, but even I know what he just said is absolute nonsense. That if you bring a gun and the other person is unarmed, you are the threat, and it can't be self-defense. Does that sound legitimate to you, just on your basic understanding of the law? Because it's not legitimate. Just because you are armed and the other person is not, does not mean the other person is not a threat. The reason why you have a gun is to protect yourself from people who are threats to you and to others, whether or not they have a gun or any weapon. We know that as a matter of law. What he just said as it relates to self-defense is just nonsense. Brian Claypool is an attorney. He was on with Fox News. And I was watching this for the most part, most of the day. And it was remarkable to me how bad that this lawyer just screwed up basic self-defense law. So here's Brian Claypool on Fox.
That's not accurate law, what Binger said. I mean, imagine if Rittenhouse was a police officer for a second, right? And the police officer put a gun up to be a deterrent, right? And then somebody throws a bag, and the police officer has no idea what's in that bag, right? And then starts charging at that police officer. Police officer turns around, and it's like within inches, and the guy's almost at the nozzle of his gun. You don't think that a police officer would deploy a deadly force at that moment? I mean, that's a ridiculous argument by Binger. You don't have to have a gun to justify using deadly force. Remember, this was not a 4th of July barbecue at a park or a birthday at bowling alley party. Binger told everybody, he told the jury, look, this was a dangerous situation, and that's what's going to help.
That's what's going to help. Now, of course, Mark Richards, the defense attorney, and like I said, the defense is still underway presenting their closing arguments, but he started right out the gate just ripping into the prosecution.
Ladies and gentlemen, this case is not a game. It is my client's life. We don't play fast and loose with the facts, pretending that Mr. Rosenbaum was citizen A number one guy. He was a bad man. He was there. He was causing trouble. He was a rioter. And my client had to deal with him that night alone.
That is what the video evidence proves. That is what the video evidence proves. There's some people, and I'm watching some of the coverage and reading some of the coverage and the analysts who went into this telling us that Kyle Rittenhouse is this evil, cold-blooded white nationalist. They now, of course, have to walk that back because it was never true. It was always absurd. But let's be clear. They're now starting to switch their tactics and talking about this, basically saying he should not have been there. He should not have gone. And you know what? I agree with that. But going there and not going there does not make him a murderer. It doesn't make him a white supremacist. He was put in a position that he put himself in, made worse by people who tried to attack him and hurt him and kill him. He was protecting himself. That is what it all suggests. And for the folks who want to pretend that that's not the case, then you haven't been paying attention. You haven't been paying attention. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. 1-800-465-8770. We got more in a bit, but right now, if you missed my Tucker Carlson appearance on Friday, make sure you go to our YouTube page, youtube.com/JasonRants. I'll also be on the Faulkner Focus tomorrow in the 8 o'clock a.m. hour. I hope you'll tune in, but if you can, again, we post all of our content at youtube.com/JasonRants. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Back the blue.
So we have some good news in we're calling it Back the Blue because it surrounds police. But at the end of the day, this is really about standing up for what's right. And what you should not be allowed to do scot-free is call people murderers. The same way people shouldn't be allowed to just simply get away with calling Kyle Rittenhouse a white supremacist because it falls in line with some sort of political position that you have. But in this case, we actually have good news as it relates to that lawsuit that had previously been tossed concerning two cops and socialist Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant. A federal court actually overturned that lower court ruling, that district court ruling. And as a result, these two cops can now sue Shama Sawant for labeling them murderers. Now, she may actually suffer consequences as a result of this, with a caveat that we'll talk about in a second. And these cops may be further cleared, because to be cleared to start, they've already been cleared. And despite being cleared, they're being labeled murderers for a case that stemmed from a 2016 shooting of felon Che Taylor. This is Andre Taylor's brother. Andre Taylor, another questionable character, former pimp, who ends up getting paid a lot of money by the city to do absolutely nothing. But his brother was a felon who ended up getting shot by these two cops because they believe they saw him with a gun. And as a felon, he's not supposed to have a gun. At the time, the police officer's attorney said this.
These officers faced a person who was a proven, very violent felon who was illegally holding a firearm at the time. He threatened their lives. They had to act.
So the two officers saw Che Taylor. They thought he had a gun. As someone who's not supposed to have a gun, they went to make an arrest. As they approached him to make the arrest, believing him to be armed, they saw him reach for what they thought was a gun. He was wearing a holster at the time. Now, the gun, it turns out, was not on him. Don't know if he was what he was reaching for, if he was reaching for anything at all. But we do know that there was a gun under the seat of his car. So he did, in fact, have a gun. It seems very likely that the officer saw that gun specifically. He then tried to hide the gun, knowing that he might get in trouble. And in the end, obviously, the cops didn't know that he was trying to hide the gun, if that's what happened. And they ended up shooting and killing him. Now, progressives want you to think that there was no gun whatsoever, that this was just a mistake by the cops. No gun existed. None. They had no reason to even get involved. When, of course, we know that that's nonsense. Even at the time, a firefighter explained what they found on Andre Taylor's body, or Che Taylor's body, excuse me.
I started cutting his pants off, starting with his right leg, and when I got to the belt, I tried to undo his belt, but I couldn't. It was a heavy-duty black leather belt, and he had a Kydex pistol holster, which was empty on the right side of the belt.
Okay. Does it seem reasonable to you that a gun found in the car and a gun holster on his belt that they reasonably thought he was armed? Now, of course, a reasonable person will say, yes, that seems reasonable to me. Reasonable people find things are within reason. Police end up getting cleared of any wrongdoing, but someone like Shama Sawant doesn't really matter to people like her because ACAB, right? So she decided to label them murderers by saying, by calling this incident a, quote, blatant murder at the hands of police. So the cops sue. But a district judge, her name is Marsha Peckman, she dismissed the lawsuit saying the cops didn't adequately claim that Sawant's remarks were, quote, of and concerning them. In other words, was she really talking about these two individuals specifically? Which is a monumentally ridiculous argument that she was making. Yes, everyone would think that she's talking about the literal cops who shot and killed Che Taylor. She's calling them murderers. But this judge says that because Sawant didn't mention them by name, even though she was talking about that specific case 5 days after at a rally in front of the SPD, she's claiming, the judge, that Sawant didn't actually defame, which is kind of stupid, but we'll move on because the federal court said, actually, no, that's horrible reasoning. I'm going with Jason Rance on that one. I don't think they included my name in the ruling, but probably is what the judge was thinking. So the judge reverses the ruling. According to the Seattle Times, in the 28-page opinion, the appeals court panel reversed Peckman's ruling, holding that, quote, Sawant's own words suggested that her remarks were directed not only at the police generally, but also at the individual officers involved in the shooting. While Sawant didn't name them, the officers' family, friends, colleagues, and members of the public, quote, knew that plaintiffs were the officers involved in the shooting and plausibly understood that Sawant's remarks were directed at them. So now it goes back to the judge at the lower court, the district court. There has to be consequences when you enact this kind of rhetoric. When you do this because you want to demonize your opponent, and for Shama Sawant, her opponents are cops. She has a reason to go after them. She wants to see them defunded. And how do you make it easier for people to accept defunding and ultimately abolition? Is you demonize them. You go after cops. You tell them cops are evil, that they are racist, that they are out of control, that they are a danger to you. They're going to murder you, especially if you happen to be black. That was the message. That was a winning message for the activists because they were allowed to get their way at the end of this. They didn't get fully 50% cut, but they had almost 20% cut from the budget. You've got another near $11 million being cut from the budget right after an election that showed very clearly that even Seattleites are saying you're going too far to the left as it relates to policing. This council is ignoring it, in part because of the work that Shama Sawant did. Now, I said there has to be consequences, and it looks like she might suffer some consequences, but I have a little bit of a caveat at that, because she's technically suffering consequences if this were to move forward. But let's be clear. We're paying for this. Taxpayers pay for all of this. Her defense right now is being paid for by us. Now, ultimately, it doesn't even matter what ends up happening. Well, I hope she's found guilty, because she very clearly is, according to the facts that we know them to be. She's going through a recall. So the timing of this is really good for it to be back in the news. We're separated enough from the original election that we've been focused on, the pre-midterms, if you will. And we're going into, what is it? It's either December 3rd or December 7th. I can't remember off the top of my head. She's got this recall election. Now, she may very well win in her favor because it is still in her district. Her district is filled with far to the left fringe progressives and socialists. So it's going to be hard to get enough people to go out and vote and actually kick her out. However, this makes it a little bit easier to connect with people. They're going to look at this story, the reasonable people who just said, hey, we don't want to demonize the cops constantly. The people who just said no to the police abolitionist in Akita Oliver on the council and the police abolitionist and prison abolitionist in Nicole Thomas Kennedy for Seattle City Attorney. So they're going to look at this and maybe, just maybe, say, you know what? We're fine. We're always going to be represented in the Capitol Hill area by a hardcore progressive on the council. We just don't want this hardcore socialist representing us. Seattle Times just put out an editorial encouraging people to vote to recall. We'll see how that ends up going. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. 1-800-465-8770. Welcome back to the Jason Rance Show. We're live on this Monday afternoon. Really do appreciate you tuning in. I've been on this theme lately, and it's completely unintentional, and I never really intended to make it a regular piece of commentary on this show about how we're leaning into the gaslighting of the American public, that things are very clearly happening, and we're all experiencing it. We can see it. We can hear it. We can feel it. And yet we're told that none of it is true. None of it is actually happening. And it's kind of maddening because I'm one of those people who likes to make sure that I'm not leaning into a bias to the point of me not reading a situation correctly. It's not to say that I don't have a bias. I'm actively saying I do. We all have a bias. Every single one of us. In and out of the media, we all have bias. We all have our pre-existing positions on certain topics, and sometimes it means we're not paying close enough attention that I dislike this administration so much that maybe I'm not being fair in how I'm reading certain stories. And so when I'm told over and over and over again that something isn't happening when it sure seems like it is, at least I have this sense initially of, did I get something wrong? Because I have this fear, given I work in a medium that breaks stories, I have this fear that I could get something wrong. And certainly I can get something wrong, and I'm assuming that mistake will happen at some point that is rather significant. I try to mitigate that as best as possible, but I'm a human. I'm assuming I will make a mistake. But I go into these things hoping not to make a mistake. I'm on edge. And so when someone tells me a thing or two about inflation, oh, it's transitory, it's not going to happen. Well, I don't necessarily just want to listen to someone who's on the right, who will, of course, take the position that it is happening because they don't like Biden as much as I don't. I want to make sure that I got it right. And I've done the research, and I know I have it right. Most people now are admitting and acknowledging, depending on their situation beforehand, that not only is inflation real, but it's here to stay for quite a while. It is not transitory. As our Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen had said many, many, many times, including after it was very clearly no longer transitory. So today, Peter Alexander from NBC News asks a question on inflation to Jen Psaki. She is back after being a breakthrough COVID case. And they asked about Build Back Better, which puts in over $1 trillion in spending into place. Nancy Pelosi was out there today at the bill signing ceremony claiming again that it's totally paid for. It is not totally paid for. That's a nonsense, made-up claim. You have to be a special kind of ignorant to believe that it's already paid for. So the conversation becomes, well, what is that going to do to inflation? You're putting a lot of money that we don't have. You're spending it all. Some of it is long-term spending. Some of it will happen, obviously, in the short term. What's that going to do? So listen to the question, but then listen to the spin from Jen Psaki.
On the state of America right now, inflation obviously at a 31-year high right now. Americans are seeing their dollars, their paychecks stretched right now. Why should Americans not be concerned that injecting another $1.75 trillion or more would further raise inflation?
Because no economist out there is projecting that this will have a negative impact on inflation.
So just real quick, and I'll let her finish. Do you believe that not a single economist is out there saying that it will cause inflation, it'll be bad? Not a single person? None. Not even one. Not even one. Not one prominent person. Say, I don't know, and this is completely at random. Larry Summers, former Obama economic advisor, who just last week said this is going to be a nightmare. He said we're going to see inflation of a kind we haven't seen in 30 years. So he very clearly is one of the people who's saying that this is going to hurt. Over the weekend, Neil Kashkar was on CBS's Face the Nation. He is the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank. He said the exact same thing. This is going on for a bit. He said, quote, the math suggests we're probably going to see somewhat higher readings over the next few months before they likely to taper off. So this idea that it's not going to continue, at least for the near future, is of course absurd. But Gaslight Nation, no one is saying it. Well, what about that person? Oh, he didn't say it. Larry Summers didn't just say what he said? No. What about the video we have and the audio and the multiple sources quoting it? Yeah, that's not true. None of it is true. It's all made up. Yeah, he didn't say it, but he did. No, he didn't. That's the conversation that is basically happening every single day.
And actually, what it will help do is will help increase economic productivity. It will help economic growth in this country. That and the Build Back Better agenda will help reduce inflation, will help cut costs for the American people over the long term.
Over the long term, she's making this case. Because when she says long term, she means at a time when they're not even in office, where they don't have to pay any political consequences for lying to you now. In the long term. Tell that to someone who right now is struggling, that maybe in a decade, the cost of milk for you and your family won't be as high. And if it is, we'll be out of power anyway. So ha 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 ha. That's what they're doing. That's what they're saying. And what's remarkable here is we keep getting someone like Jennifer Granholm out there, the former governor who's now the energy secretary. Gas prices are through the roof. Now, it doesn't hit me the same as it might hit you as someone who doesn't own a car. I don't drive. I rarely fill up the vehicle when I borrow it from the station. And usually when it's almost out of gas, I just leave it in the parking lot for someone else to figure out because I don't want to touch it. But I saw this story today in the Times talking about gasoline prices in this region, in the Seattle metro area. Third quarter last year, so year over year. Last year, it was $2.86 a gallon, $2.86. Right now, it's $4.21. That's over 47% increase in the cost of gas. And if you're someone who relies on your vehicle for work, that obviously hurts every time you have to go and get gas. Well, you should be driving an electric car, they say, as if it's that easy just to go ahead and buy a new car. But Secretary Granholm was on CNN, and she said, oh, no, don't worry, we got you.
The president is all over this.
He
really is very concerned about, you know, inflation, obviously, and the price of gasoline, because that's the most obvious manifestation of it. And as you know, no president controls the price of gas. Oil is sold on a global market.
That part's true. We could drill for oil domestically, but you refuse to do that because Democrats don't want us to use oil. You could have not closed down the pipeline. You chose to do that anyway. You could use our reserves. You can open up some of our strategic reserves, but you're also choosing not to do that, which would immediately bring down the cost of gas. But beyond that, the president has no control. He's helpless.
As we see, as everybody's coming out of COVID, there is a huge increase in demand. The supply has not caught up. So the president is looking at the limited tools that he has. I have nothing to announce on this, but he is looking and evaluating all of his options, limited though they may be in the United States.
So hold on. You said, he's all over this, but it's limited in what he can do. So he's not really all over this. Number two, you're saying he's all over this. He's addressing it. What is he doing? We've not yet made any determinations as to what we're going to do. So then he's not doing anything. So literally nothing is being done. You are, quote unquote, looking at things. I gave you right there, and I'm not obviously the only person to say this, the idea of going into our reserves. Not forever, but for a little bit. That's an idea. You're rejecting it. Okay, fine. You don't have to take my idea. What else are you going to do? You don't know yet. But we are to believe that you're all over it anyway. Then you got Stephanie Ruhle, MSNBC host who blocked me on Twitter. She said something pretty outrageous this morning, and it really truly shows the level of elitism that we're dealing with.
And the dirty little secret here, Willie, while nobody likes to pay more, on average, we have the money to do so. Household savings hit a record high over the pandemic. We didn't really have anywhere to go out and spend. And as we said a moment ago, we're expecting retail sales this holiday season to break records.
It's not going to break records because we don't have the products on the shelves. There might be demand, but there's no supply. And this idea of the dirty little secret is we can afford it. There was record amounts of savings because things were closed. Now, that part's true. Things were closed. You spent less of your money. For the first time, you had some savings. This country has a population that's really bad at savings. People had it, and not only have the savings been wiped out, but what else is happening? The dollar is not worth as much anymore. It doesn't go as far. inflation, the consumer price index going up, what, 6.8%, 6.7% in October? So that $1 is worth less than it was last year when you were saving. So your savings, you finally got it going, but now you got to spend it. But unfortunately, it doesn't go as far as it would last year because of the total incompetence from this administration. Now, depending where you live, you're hit slightly differently. So, for example, here in Washington, and although I think it's across the board, I gave you the gasoline numbers through the roof. But we've heard the conversations about purchasing milk, right? Well, milk locally is down. It went from 304 to 239. Is that the case everywhere? No, not at all. Overall, when you look across the board, prices are up. Prices are up. Bananas went from 59 cents to 67%. Okay, it's 13.5% increase or so. No, that's not that big of a deal. What if you have a pet? What if you have a four-year-old dog and you're bringing them in for a routine annual exam the way that you're supposed to so you can keep them living for as long as you can? Well, that went up 25%. That went up 25%. What about just going out? And you know what? You don't even treat yourself all that often, but every once in a while you go to McDonald's. Okay, quarter pounder with cheese went from $4.87 to $6.83. When fast food goes up in such high numbers, guess what? It impacts the amount of people who go out to those restaurants, which impacts the people who work there who are low wage and low skill. Purchasing jeans for your son, your young son, that went up 45%. Overall, it went from $30 on average to $43.75. Your washing machine is broken? Guess what? You're paying more for that too. 12.5% increase. You're going to the doctor's office now? You have to in a lot of cases because everyone's trying to freak you out about COVID. You have a sniffle and all of a sudden you think you've got COVID. You go in. Well, a doctor's office visit went up 11%. All of this matters. Now, to someone like Stephanie Ruhle, who hasn't paid for a meal on her own for a very long time, just send the intern out to go get you your salad, yell at them if there's any corn in it. You know I don't like corn. Pick it out with your fingers, and I better not taste your fingers in my salad. To people like that, this doesn't matter. It's a dirty little secret. She can afford it, so you must be able to as well. Shame on these people and the way that they talk. They don't care about the struggles. Or if they care, they're hiding it. They're hiding it. I guess they don't want people to think they have a heart. 1-800-465-8770. If you want to join the conversation, send me a text. 1-800-465-8770. Don't forget, tomorrow morning, I'll be on with Harris Faulkner on the Faulkner Focus. Be on in the 8 a.m. hour. Then tomorrow night, I'll be on with Fox News at Night and Shannon Bream. I think I'm on with Varney and Company on Wednesday. Lots of fun stuff. I'm going to get to what Ballard has become, the neighborhood in Seattle, when we come back. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. I did something I don't normally do, which is go to Ballard over the weekend. I went there because I was doing a story, which is available right now with lots of photos over at ktth.com, or just text the keyword Rants, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. I went to check out the homeless recording studio. This homeless man who has put a second story on his broken down RV. It's just plywood. It doesn't actually have a roof. And he said that it was for homeless music studio recording. Now, there's no electricity. I don't quite understand it. But I went out there because I wanted to check it out and take some photos. Like I said, they're online at ktth.com. And, you know, Ballard, in a lot of ways, is kind of difficult for most Seattleites to get to. There's not that many ways in and out of Ballard, so I just avoid it completely. But when I went there, it somehow hasn't gotten even a little bit better. Arguably, it's gotten worse than it was a year ago when I went to Ballard covering the homelessness situation. It's gotten worse. You go down pretty much any street, residential or business, and you are likely to find some semblance of an encampment, either a large one with several tents or maybe one tent, lots of trash everywhere. Ballard, a neighborhood in Seattle that once was picturesque to the point that you can put it on a postcard. People actually wanted to live there. Families wanted to live there. Completely changed. Completely changed. because of our out-of-control homelessness. And it's out of control because we've allowed it as a city to become out of control. People living wherever it is they want to live, regardless of their impact on your business or your quality of life. You no longer get that park. You no longer get that sidewalk. You no longer get that parking spot. Homeless people in Ballard want it. And what they want, they get. Because in Ballard, it's represented by a council member by the name of Dan Strauss. Dan Strauss is not a council member to represent the taxpayers. He represents the homeless. He represents the homeless. He will let them camp out wherever it is they want to. And if you call and complain, if you have a question even, you will be completely ignored. Dan Strauss is not in this job for you. He's in it to be an activist. He likes it on his resume. He's not going anywhere after this. He's not going to take on a bigger position. He lacks all talent. He doesn't know what he's doing as a council member. In a lot of ways, he kind of stays quiet so that he doesn't get hit with some of the brand perception of this council. But anyone who knows that you're a Seattle city council member, they're going to judge you. I say this because so many communities feel like they're lost. And people like you maybe listening feel like it's a lost cause. And then you got this last election. And it was so significant. We said no to the police defunding candidates. We said no. We rejected Nicole Thomas Kennedy for Seattle City Attorney. We rejected Lorena Gonzalez for mayor. And we rejected Nikita Oliver for city council. And instead, we got people who are pro-police. We may not agree on everything that a council member, Sarah Nelson, does. She's a Democrat. We're not going to believe in everything that Bruce Harrell does as a mayor. He's a Democrat. We'll obviously agree with more coming from Ann Davison as a Republican than not. But even there, we're not going to agree on everything. But we felt some momentum, only to have the council come out and basically say, oh, yeah, we don't care what you think. We're going to continue to do what we want to do. And for a lot of people, that can be quite disappointing, to the point where it kills some of the momentum you felt, some of the passion you felt, thinking, wow, we can change things. And I imagine right now there's someone who's walking around their neighborhood, whether it's in Ballard, in Seattle, or Puyallup, and you're seeing some things that you still don't like. And you realize, oh, one election didn't change anything. It's true, one election doesn't change anything. Multiple elections do. You can lose an entire city on an election. You can lose an entire county or a state on one election. But you can't necessarily bring one back after one election. You still need some momentum. You need some power shifting. You need to make sure that we're putting the right people in positions of power. And every single time they say no to you, every single time they say they're going to ignore, guess what? They end up winning if you allow that. If you allow them to win, they will. So do not allow it. Start fighting on behalf of your communities in between elections. Folks who live in Ballard should be going to these meetings. They're all digital. Sign up and say something. Keep the pressure on. Take photos of what's going on in your community. Post them online so that they can spread, so we can see what's happening and call it out.